This is a report of one of the many reasonings with Trevor Monroe, one of the leading intellectual agents of Russian state capitalism in the Caribbean today, who, along with other party leaders, have been suppressing the content and knowledge of the real class struggle taking place there through the traditional practice of this state capitalist ideology to satisfy the false so-called United Front of representative organizations.
Jim Trevor made a statement that the world revolutionary process led by the Soviet Union and the National Liberation Forces. And I said to him that that is not true, because what amounts in Russia today is a redivision of class society under the economic arrangement of state capitalism administrated by a group of technicians and bureaucrats and wage slaves working in the factories and producing things. And that has been reproduced in the other Eastern European countries and is now a burden on the working class struggle throughout the world. So that is not what leading the working class struggle. What is leading the working class struggle in the world is the world proletariat. He said, no, that is false. That is counter-revolutionary. You know, there are moments in history, in 1921, as far back as 1921 in Kronstadt, that's 3 years after the revolution, the workers revolted. And they were just asking at that time for elementary reforms. And just last year in Poland, there had been revolts against the party hierarchy for improvement in working conditions. And in 1956, there was a big revolution in Hungary. He said, no, those were counter-revolutionary activities on the part of the workers. So I said, you mean that the millions of workers in Hungary in 1956 that acted so defiantly that it took the armed intervention of Russia with tanks and killing thousands of workers, you mean that all those workers are wrong, all of them is counter-revolutionary? He said, yes, workers in history have been counter-revolutionary. I say, to that extent, that in that great quantity, all acting in the same manner. Well, he was unable to answer that. So I said, what you are trying to reproduce in the Caribbean today is what George Padmore had passed through. Because if you had concerned yourselves with the experiences of George Padmore seriously, what Russia asked George Padmore to do between 1930-something and 40, in the 1940s, when he was a very, very prominent international communist, member of the Communist Party, and he was given a post, something like a general of the Red Army of Russia. He was such a prominent black man in the communist hierarchy that he was recognized all over the world as such, and was very influential in the National Liberation Movement in Africa. And what Russia, the Communist Party, called upon him to do was to use his influence to contain the struggle of Africans against the colonialism of the French and the British. And the reason for that is because Russia was into some kind of military alliance in the form of an allied treaty with America, France, Britain and Russia. And what the Communist Party was arguing is that the liberation, the struggle for against the colonization of these territories would have used up the military resources of Britain and France to suppress that struggle. And this now would have weakened the military strength in this allied arrangement. So what in effect Russia was doing is to sacrifice the end of colonialism so as to suit some military arrangement that he claims was to be against fascism. But I say, you don't remember that? And not only that, but that is the most prominent act of the Communist Party of Russia that disturbed particularly black people who call themselves communists all over the world. It was a very prominent thing. And most of the criticism of the so-called third world is in that particular regard. But separate and apart from that, which is popular knowledge among so-called third world people, is what the Communist Party did in Spain, in actually a part of suppressing the real revolutionary forces in Spain. They did it in Indonesia, they did it in Greece, they did it in Ceylon. The Communist Party of Guadeloupe, which is a French territory in the Caribbean, suppressed, outrightly participated with the police to suppress the riots of the workers. And this is in keeping with the French Communist Party, because the Communist Party of both Britain and France had always supported the colonization of the territories. That is what the French Communist Party was notorious for during the Algerian Revolution. And that is what we want to reproduce in the Caribbean today. So what the workers need is workers' councils, both in the workplace and in the villages. And this had begun. There was some making of this in the area of Westmoreland, which right of forces suppressed. And another person intervened and said, but you're shifting the argument to something else. What we're talking about is some work is a world situation. The chairman asks, what about the Cuban Revolution? Do you support the Cuban Revolution? I said, there's much to reside in the Cuban Revolution. There was some, of course, there's some democratic reforms over to what existed during the time of Batista. There have been an end to much of the kind of suppression of the population, and certain economic arrangements have been changed and so forth and so on. Then he kind of laughed and said, do you support the Cuban Revolution? So I said, there's much to be desired. I'm reading the content of it. What has happened? He said, do you support the Cuban Revolution? I said, you have to reason that way. As to, you have to reason the content of it. I reminded him that the revolution was fought without a communist party. The Communist Party of Cuba at that time was one of those armchair cliques that was doing a whole lot of talking and sitting back, wasn't participating in no activity at all whatsoever. At the last moment when the 26th of July forces called for a general strike in keeping with the entry of the military forces into Havana, the Communist Party didn't even respond at the time when they were active in the unions.
The working class that supported the 26th of July movement into power didn't need the Communist Party of Cuba, but Fidel and others incorporated it into their state bureaucracy to institutionalize the authority and carry out more efficiently the state-capitalist relations with Russia.
So what is happening in Cuba now is a new bureaucracy has set up itself. Whereas, on the other hand, Cuba could have provided the example that without a Communist Party, they could have established the principles and practice of workers' councils in Cuba. So a new bureaucracy is set up there and workers just continue. So it is still a reform. So my God, man, you know, he's responding terribly. I said, well, the Caribbean don't want any parties at the moment. No, that's not the Caribbean situation, man. He said, really talking, you're repeating what Nixon say. I said, what Nixon say? I said, that's what Nixon said. And Nixon said, the people don't want any party, I want any leadership, something to that effect. I said, don't equate what I said with Nixon, man. I'll give the content of what we are saying. I said, parties have been a burden over and over, have been a burden upon people. He responded that since the 1 year that the PMP have been in power, forces from all over the country have been telling him, coming to him and say, let us form a party now, man, and petty bourgeois forces strong in it, and revolutionary forces, and all kind of people. He's saying, come, let us form a party now. I say, but that still is not, you see, people, the main voice that is saying all of that is the petty bourgeois forces, as you say, but the proletariat is fighting at a day-to-day level for some kind of changes. They are putting up all kind of resistance and so forth. But one of his colleagues chimed in and said that what you want is a leaderless arrangement. You want a leaderless process in the thing going on, you know, struggle going on in the Caribbean. You're a Trotskyist. I said, look, man, let us reason the content matters that the name calling. I'm not a Trotskyist. and he go on and sell other things. I said, look, I want to make a record straight, right? Because I'm not a Trotskyist. Trotsky was talking about the militarization of the trade unions in Russia. And he was talking about a party. He was talking about all things. The difference between Trotsky and Stalin was one of the power struggle of bureaucrats. And didn't have much in content as to fundamental differences regarding the interests of the workers.
What is passed off as Trotsky's ideology of permanent revolution was to reproduce in other parts of Europe at the time the vanguard party model of revolution, so as to consolidate the state capitalist bureaucracy of the Bolsheviks at the time. He was notorious more than anyone else for ordering the murder of the proletariat of Kronstadt, Petrograd, and the Maknaite movement in the Ukraine. And therefore, there was nothing left in Russia to export that was useful to the international class struggle.
They say, you're an anarchist. My God. They said, no, I am for organization, man. Do you know I'm for organization? What was the struggle in ITAC? Wasn't the struggle in ITAC for a genuine and real organization versus a bureaucracy that was setting up itself over and above the activities of the workers there? But that is not what we are talking about now. That is what his colleague insisted again. That is not what we are talking about now. Finish this part of it, man, about the international situation. Then the question of the class divisions now. He said there is a semi-proletariat. There's the lumpen proletariat. There's the unemployed and there's the working class. My God. I've heard the others, but I've never heard semi yet. I mean, what is semi? He's like, well, when you work sometimes and don't work sometimes. And that so what is the unemployed? As being different from the lumpen proletariat. Is that the unemployed, they are parasites and criminals and the working class, which I gather it means people who's employed, is extremely vexed with them and concerned over the crime that is committed against them. I said, look, there have been so-called crimes committed against them. Crimes, I would admit that it's crimes committed against workers in the form of these petty robberies. But haven't you seen over the years a marked trend in which there's much less robbery of individuals, individual homes and individual persons, and there's more towards appropriation of banks and warehouses and things like that? Isn't that the case? You refuse to state that fact and keep insisting that the unemployed are parasites and criminals. And so you're calling the backbone of the struggles that have brought about whatever reforms that people have and brought about whatever effective struggle in the Caribbean today, you're calling them parasites? And so? You say, look, man, the workers there is not some kind of above criticism, you know, or some kind of so perfect that you don't criticize them. So that is not a criticism. That is not true. You know, they are not parasites. The economic arrangement that is in the society has been using some as wage slaves, and some just while they want to get some kind of work is unable to do so completely outside of their influence or anything. And as such, they are not parasites.
While there are many wildcat strikes in the Caribbean, it is the struggle of the unemployed and youth man them that more exposes the contradictions in the society and even the contradictions within the movement itself that claims to represent that struggle. It is now April 1973, and everyone thought that by now Joshua, the Prime Minister, would have at least known where he's taking the people to.
The night before, they had got a report that the government had declared a state of emergency arising from a spate of arson in the city. And this, $2 million would have fire damage was done, like over some short period of time, like in a week or 2 weeks. And there were riots and demonstrations. And the Jamaica Chamber of Commerce had called Jamaica Chamber of Commerce and the Jamaica Employers Federation and called upon the government to declare to impose in that state of emergency situation arising from the arsons and the riots that looters should be shot on sight. And this arson, according to him now, this arson is having an effect upon the working class, because there was a factory there that was burnt down and something like so many hundred workers lost their jobs. And the guy talking away that he's worried about the workers having to lose their jobs arising from the from this arson. And he's trying to pose now a kind of artificial conflict as though the working class is suffering from certain spontaneous, you know, radical activity on the part of unemployed or whoever that was doing it. So his interpretation always posed one section of the workers versus the other section, that kind of thing. And I suppose it's in that situation that he sees himself as some leader that comes in with a party to rationalize and teach and lead. But a kind of summary comment, though, is that I gather as a person, as an individual, he is arrogant and contemptuous of the possibilities of the working class there. I can't really find words to express his contempt and disrespect for the unemployed and those real brethren who in the first place had been the midwife, so to speak, of their union, because they were the very ones who he's calling parasites, that met the physical force of the reactionary union that's just trying to keep them out, a situation which they themselves wasn't prepared to handle. So I see him a notorious, a very dangerous person. And then the press is promoting him. The press is doing with him just what they did with the Black Panther Party in America. Yeah, they built the party to the state where it was almost uncriticizable. It's like it was a crime to criticize the Black Panther Party, the extent to which the press put them up as some great and terrible liberation force. So both the bourgeois press and the radical press of the Caribbean is doing that with Monroe. So it has gone to his head in no ordinary way. He feels he's second to the Prime Minister. So it has flew to his head that he's the leader in the Caribbean. You know, and having audience with Cheddy Jagan, who was a chief minister of Guyana and one of the leading Leninists, and was transformed the PPP, which is the People's Progressive Party in Guyana, into a communist party, Marxist-Leninist party, so to speak, and was a direct agent of Moscow. So he's one of the leaders, along with Jagan, of what they call the Anti-Imperialist Alliance of the Caribbean, which is made up of the Leninist parties and Leninist individuals. So he functions at this Caribbean level in the Anti-Imperialist Alliance of Leninist parties, and at a local level in the Leninist activity of ITAC and so forth. But ITAC as an organization is almost finished, not doing anything. Now, when you don't see what is happening in Suriname, reported in the New York Times, I think it's a serious matter. I mean, in Suriname, there's a general strike, and there's an end to economic life in the country, and chaos is reigning over there for weeks upon weeks, and a general arson and riots just going on just like that. And in other words, a revolutionary situation, like equal that of France in 68. It's happening. And it's like it's only the papers of the Caribbean, like the Guyana Express and Jamaica, yeah, the Sabina, yeah, they reported in some state. and in Guyana, the massive takeover of land by sugar workers. So there's a very, very anarchic situation in the Caribbean there. And in Trinidad, there's this extraordinary confrontation with the unemployed too, and the government forces. So the whole Caribbean there, it seems, is that the men them, but all of these governments, interesting to note, they are the liberal governments that just took over the other day, you know, from the so-called traditional reactionary ones. And strange enough, have been more oppressive. Oh, I forgot something in Vietnam. And he said, what about Vietnam? I said, oh, that's a terrible situation. Because the North Vietnamese, the Communist Party, and Russia have not them, have sold out the Vietnamese people. Oh, I mean, that is like, he said, what? I said, yes, as they did in 1954. And which in turn, the real revolutionary forces there and the people were faced with fighting another war in the same way that couple years after now, they're going to fight another war. I said, I don't understand. I said, look, just the other day, and this was reported in the New York Times, but I'm telling you now, that Pope had to tell Thu to let go of the Viet Cong prisoners. Imagine that. While the last American prisoner of war has left, the Communist Party, the North Vietnamese army has left, and the real proletarian forces in the very town, in the very country there, you know, that have been the backbone of the resistance are still in prison and was not and their release was not negotiated for. I said, that is an outright sellout, man. What do I mean? That is a sellout. The real revolutionary forces, again, everywhere in the world you go, they have always been sold out and isolated. They are always the burden bearers. Some of the other, I gather that he wasn't aware of that as a fact. So it is two things I gather from him, both his bureaucratic attitude and the fact, and which in turn, somehow or the other, it seems as if this bureaucratic attitude steer people away from certain facts. So that means you will speak into them and they are totally ignorant of certain facts, which makes it even more difficult to reason with them. Well, I remind him too that there have been very deep economic arrangements with capitalists of America and the state capitalists of Russia. In mining, there's American investment being set up in Russia here to mine natural gas. Chase Manhattan Bank had set up a branch there. Again, he don't seem to have been aware of this fact. Because he said, he look at me, so. I said, yes, Chase Manhattan set up a bank there, what happened? You didn't know that? And he said, So it looked like to me like just a list of facts. It's a whole lot of, it's just by itself without even saying anything else is important. But that is about it. But the most gripping thing though is the extent of the contempt that this guy has for the proletariat, for the real proletarian and the real comrades in J.E. Adair that has been incarcerated in the prisons.
The lessons of history. What is necessary now is a consciousness of what has already been done. The party approach has succeeded only in taking state power, but they have failed to emancipate the working class. In every so-called socialist or communist state, in China, just as in Russia, as in Cuba, the workers still slave while others tell them what to do. In every case where bourgeois society has floundered, when the existing power was completely eroded, we have had to learn to take matters into our own hands and to deal with the day-to-day administration of society. It was at these times that we formed workers' councils. Our efforts as workers to take control over our own lives have succeeded, and succeeded with surprising ease in the beginning, when the spontaneous organization of the armed people swept before it the police and armies of the established order. But we have failed to maintain that control. What caused our failure? When we look closely at our history of struggle, you see that we have always carried with us the illusion that the parties and unions are our friends. Each time we have given a part of our authority to them, it was these very powers that betrayed us. This time, as we prepared for the final assault on class society, we do so with the knowledge of who the enemy is. What are the councils? They are the general assemblies of the local proletariat in the factories and in the residences. What defines the power of the councils? The dissolution of all external power, direct and total democracy, the practical unification of decision and execution, the delegate strictly mandated, subject to immediate recall, the abolition of all hierarchies and independent specializations, the management and conscious transformation of all aspects of liberated life, the creative permanent participation of all individuals, international extension and coordination. The workers' councils are not what exists in Yugoslavia, where they are merely appendages of the state. The councils will not negotiate with either parties or unions. They are the only power, or they are nothing. A dilemma presents itself. We see that the councils, as we mean them, cannot exist in their true form, except in a situation of total revolt, when they are the only effective power. And it is here that the parties say, just as I said, there must be a party to prepare the way. When this problem was posed in 1917, the proletariat was not experienced enough to overcome it, but it is not enough to be anti-bureaucratic. It's now 1973, and the Situationist International has further clarified the experience of the councils and elaborated its theory in various texts and provided an example of what is to be done through their organizational practice. We agree there must be some kind of organization to prepare the way, to radicalize spontaneous revolt, to support the councils against their enemies wherever they emerge. But we also know that the hierarchical form of the party is the opposite of what is needed. The alternative to the party is a councilist organization, which practices internally the non-hierarchical relations that will be everywhere present in the society of the councils. By non-hierarchical relations, we mean that all decisions are taken by those who are affected by them. And this goes for all aspects of activity, and especially on the question of how money is used in this period when it still exists as a mediation between people. Everyone must have an equal voice in financial matters, no matter what portion of the money they actually contributed to the common purse. When our problems of survival is attended to in this way, there is no separation between our private life and political life. This practice is what will end the inequality of women in organizations that want to be revolutionary. Our effort is to unite our theory to our practice, and at the moment of spontaneous revolt, to unite and eventually dissolve our council's example in the manifestation of the absolute power of the councils.